You're listening to the Cash and Burn podcast, and I'm your host, Brandon Metcalf. Join me as I interview and have conversations with founders and leaders about the greatest obstacles and challenges they've faced while building their businesses. Learn how they overcame them and ultimately what made them successful. The podcast is brought to you by Place. Place is a B2B SaaS customer subscription management, billing, forecasting, and metrics platform powered by Salesforce. Growing SaaS businesses use Place to better align their revenue and finance teams so they can boost revenue growth and retention, manage renewals, collect cash faster, and make more informed decisions all directly inside of Salesforce. Hey everyone, welcome back to Cash and Burn. I'm excited today. I have a guest that I've been waiting to get on the show. I think it's going to be a jam-packed episode and we're going to quickly run out of time. So Lloyd Lobo, he's the co-founder and board member at Boast AI. He also founded the Traction Community. And now he's a new author. He has a new book that is literally just about to come out called Grassroots to Greatness. Lloyd, welcome to the show.
I'm stoked, man. I love the name too, Cash and Burn. You know, we often crash and burn en route to getting to cash.
Yeah, and cash will cause you to crash and burn, no doubt. So why don't you tell everyone about you, your background, all of that?
Definitely. I'm an immigrant founder, refugee of the Gulf War that inadvertently got into entrepreneurship. I mean, I guess it was inevitable in many ways. So my name, Lloyd, is spelled with an E. And growing up, I got bullied a ton. And I'd ask my mom, why did you spell my name wrong? And she'd always say, I dreamed of you becoming an entrepreneur. And I knew that if it was just Lloyd, like the typical English name, you would never be able to trademark it. So she willed it into existence, I guess, fast forward so many years. But my experiences in my childhood is what I think shaped me to eventually become an entrepreneur. So my childhood was spent in Kuwait. The summers I would spend in the slums of Mumbai. My mom and her 9 siblings grew up in Mumbai. My grandparents lived in the slums there. 4 walls made out of, I don't know what, raw cement or something like that with an aluminum roof. And so every summer I'd go there and like puddles would turn into ponds. They didn't have a bathroom in the house. So you'd use a public bathroom. Not many homes had TVs. So watching TV was a communal thing. And it was the best experience of my life. Every time I'd have to go back home to Kuwait, I'd cry and not want to leave. Fast forward a few years, the Gulf War happened in Kuwait. One day, my mom wakes me up in the late summer before we go to school. And she's like, I don't think you can go to school anymore. The war has broken out. Now, my first reaction was that of excitement because I was pretty sure I'd failed the fourth grade exam. I had a learning disability. I'm pretty sure I couldn't. I hate reading and writing. And so writing this book was also a big challenge for me. And so I study last minute all the time. Procrastinate or anything reading, writing. And then I study for a math exam. It ends up being a geography exam. And I knew I was going to fail. So when my mom says, you can't go to school, a war is broken out, my first reaction was, yes, you're never going to find out I fail. But then as I looked at the worry on their faces, like the reality sank in. That day, I went down to the building with my dad and I saw a bunch of worried faces. I'm like, uh-oh, things are real. Like, you know, as a 9-year-old or so, you're like, okay, you're in the middle of this. It's a time when there were no cell phones. There was no internet. The phone lines were disconnected. Security had lapsed in the country. This is a time where people should have been really worried. I mean, in 2023, when you see, right, we belabor on bad news. We belabor on problems. And they stretch and they perpetuate and turn into like manifestations of monsters. But back then, we didn't belabor on the problem, man. Like, we saw a bunch of people down the building who were all worried, and they immediately started solving it, trying to solve it. Like, okay, you know what? What's the thing we need immediately? We'll guard the building from 6 to 12. Somebody else will guard it from 12 to 6. There was another person that said, hey, we have family members displaced. They said, okay, we'll organize shelter. And so that building became a sub-community and started organizing, self-organizing. Every building, I feel, became a sub-community, and word of mouth spread from building to building, and it became the largest grassroots evacuation movement that took people from that country to safety, coordinating with governments, with embassies, with the UN, and they've made a movie on this. But that experience was formative for me for 2 reasons. One, it was my first, I guess, taste of entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship is not all about making money and business. The entrepreneurial spirit is taking an obscure idea to execution and impact with speed while dealing with extreme risk and uncertainty. No bigger risk than trying to evacuate people during a Gulf War. Aligning around a big purpose, right? Where the smallest person, a 9-year-old child, was down there day in, day out, feeling like I'm part of the greater mission to evacuate this country, right? Never once I felt like I wasn't driving it, although I was like the lowest at the totem pole there, but I was helping out. And that was also my big experience with the power of how communities can come together to change the world. And fast forward a few years, moved to Canada, studied engineering. After I finished engineering, I was craving like not doing a 9-to-5 job, like craving something that had risk and uncertainty. So I asked a few people in business back then in 2005-06, nobody would use the word startup. It wasn't prevalent, right? People would say businessman. And so I'd asked a few family members who were in business, like, hey, what's the best skill I can learn? And they'd say sales is everything. Sales fixes everything. You need to be able to communicate your ideas, to convince customers, convince your spouse, because you're not going to bring money for the longest time. You're going to convince early employees to work on low pay, potentially investors, customers, even like when you have employees, getting them to work is a way of communication, aligning them. So I said to myself, hey, man, I'm a crappy communicator. I'm an engineer. I've like been heads down all my life. So how do I get better at this? I actually had the fear of public speaking. It took a lot for me to learn to public speak. So I said, what would be the best way for me to learn to communicate really well? What would put me in a situation? So I started applying to sales jobs, because if you think about it, there is no job on the planet that forces you to communicate as much as a sales job does, right? You communicate for a living. You polish your messaging on the fly. You pivot your thinking on the fly. You negotiate. You build rapport. All of these things, doing that day in, day out, compound interest over years, makes you a good communicator. So I took a job in sales that actually, it was cold calling, because I applied to a number of sales jobs from Xerox all the way to the smallest companies, and nobody would want to hire an engineer in sales back then. So I begged my way into getting a cold calling job, and I still remember I must have spent 4 hours practicing for my first call. And when the DM, when the decision maker came on, I hung up. That's how nervous I was.
It happens.
So then over time, you know, I got better and better, but my parents were so embarrassed, right? Immigrant parents now in Canada, from Kuwait, from a poor background in India. And they would be like, why would you do this job getting paid $30,000, picking the phone and calling? Our friends' kids who finished engineering, they're at Microsoft, et cetera. But fast forward today, it's the skill that served me the most.
No doubt. I mean, sales is just kind of baked into everything, right? Because like you're saying, it's not just about convincing someone to buy something. It's how you interact with people and how you communicate and get your message across, how you get people to understand who you are and what you're trying to talk about. But I also think there's the other side of it. What makes a really good salesperson is understanding the person you're talking to and what they're looking for and why they're looking for it. And you, when you start to apply that in other aspects of your life, it really just makes you someone that people want to engage with in a more meaningful way.
And that experience, what you just said, right? A good salesperson is one who listens and seeks to understand the customer, and then in a consultative way presents the solutions. So that's the approach I took, because I couldn't be this high-flying salesperson on the phone because I was nervous, and it worked out in my advantage. But then the next job I took was I moved from Canada to the States. I moved to New Jersey. My girlfriend, now wife, she was in medical school there, and she said she wouldn't move to Canada because, you know, there's just the career opportunities for doctors in the U.S. is much better, obviously. So I start applying to jobs, and I get a visa, and I end up working for a company in sales. For me, it was a big career move from a cold caller making $30,000 to now making $50,000 in sales as a base salary. When I go there, though, this company doesn't really have any repeatable, scalable process. They work with big customers. It was a supply chain software company, and they raised some money, maybe 10, 15 people there. So in many ways, a small startup. And my job was going and talking to big customers like Tiffany, Armani, Simon & Schuster, these big brand names, and trying to understand their pain points and then figure out what to build by creating wireframes and spec docs for the developers. And then what I also had to do was build a website and create the marketing materials. Nice. So I'm like,
well, it was a startup.
So my first reaction was, man, this is not the job I really signed up for, like doing all of these things. And I know this in 2023, a lot of kids would just quit. But I didn't have the luxury of quitting because, you know, I wanted to be with my girlfriend. And, you know, fast forward today, she's the number one reason why I have everything, because she persevered. That's why I went through failure after failure and I was able to do this. And so I said, I can't quit. I'm on a visa. I have no option. So let me start learning. The cold calling skills were great because it helped me communicate and understand the pains and the needs. From software engineering school, I already knew how to wireframe and write spec docs, so I just got better at it. But now marketing and product marketing, all of these things I didn't know. So I started Google searching how to do marketing and product marketing and SEO. And this was 2005, 6, and none of this stuff was really prevalent. And so all the content I started finding was from HubSpot's inbound marketing community. Hmm. HubSpot barely had a product, I think, but all I found, everything like video creation, SEO, HubSpot was ranking number one. So I joined the inbound marketing community, went to a few meetups. I started taking the inbound marketing classes and I just got better and better at it. That HubSpot inbound marketing community became my community. I still remember Gary Vaynerchuk had a video on there. He's like a young chubby guy running Wine TV. He was evangelizing the benefits of video and why you got to go all in on video content creation. And of course, it's played out in a big way because, you know, he kept doing it and doing it and doing it. And those two skills combined were really helpful, right? And as you look back now, every major success is a combination of three things, three skills. One is your ability to communicate. Communication is the rails of everything we do. If you can't communicate, you can't connect. And if you can't do that, you don't have an audience. You have an empty room. The second thing is your ability to create. So that translating the customer ideas into product ideas for the developers was a really good formative experience. Creating content for the website, creating videos, all of that was a great experience. And then the third thing without which everything fails is consistency. Like doing those things consistently, communicating and creating consistently is what helped me in a big way. And if you look at Gary Vaynerchuk, he is Gary V because he never stopped, right?
Yeah.
Jason Lemkin wrote the foreword in my book, and one of his key quotes is, consistency is the secret ingredient that turns small actions into big outcomes. And if you look at Jason Lemkin's journey after EchoSign, he was writing 2-3 pieces of content on Quora every day that turned into his blog, and he just never stopped, right? Or if you look at who the single richest person in SaaS is, it's Larry Ellison. He kept going and going and never sold a share. Or in investing, it's Warren Buffett because he just kept going. Compound interest on consistency is what we call overnight success.
Yeah, and it's what a lot of people give up on. So like the trick to all of it is just, like you're saying, keep going. The persistence, the perseverance, finding a way. It may not be the way you expected it to be, but that's just life. Like, roll with the punches, pivot where you need to, but be smart about it. Don't pivot just for the sake of pivoting. Pivot because it's really what you should do. So take a step back and really try to understand what you're trying to solve and why. I mean, it's what has saved a lot of my companies. It's like, all right, I need to learn. I need to learn from customers. I need to learn from investors. I need to learn from my employees. But at the end of the day, how do we keep going? How do we get past this? And, you know, there's always the talks about the valleys of death when you're building a company, of, you know, getting to 1 million, and then you go into a valley of death of trying to get to 5 million, and then you go into the next one, because you're just constantly faced with different challenges and different obstacles that you got to figure out, okay, this is new. Like, what do we do now? And how do we get past it? Well, before we get in, I want to talk about some of your stories, because especially around, you know, the personal and mental health with building companies, I think there's some powerful stuff there. And then also around focus. What does Boast do?
Definitely. So I'll tell you how I landed on Boast. So all my life, I've only worked for startups, small companies. I've never experienced a big company. So I guess that came from my drive and affinity towards risk and uncertainty growing up. So after I worked at that company, I ended up working at another startup. And the CEO of that startup, who's now a great friend, but at the time had a lot of investor pressure. You know, first-time founder, you raise investor money, and investors want something that you're not aligned with. It creates a lot of pressure. So his only way was to relay that pressure onto the team. And I went from, now my career went from being a cold caller to next job being in sales, which was actually being a Renaissance salesperson doing everything, to then being a director of sales. And then the next startup I joined was head of GTM on the leadership team. So that was the path, and it was very quick. But what I found myself quickly is I'm working now till 9, 10 o'clock, right? It's chaotic. Everyone's stressed out. The culture is eroding. The CEO is stressed. I went to a couple of board meetings, and I understood why. When you take money from investors, especially those who are not sophisticated, they're breathing down your neck. And I used to be in the office till like 9, 10 every day. One week, I started going home at 6. My wife was in residency anyway in Philly, and you know, residents in medicine, especially in ER, work 100 hours a week anyway. Yeah. So I get an email from him that says, "Hey man, I used to love it when you were in the office till 9, 10 o'clock. Your wife, and this is two days in me going six. On third day, he sends me this email. I used to love it, right? When you're in the office till 9, 10. But I've seen this week you're going at 6. Your wife is in residency, so she's working 100-hour weeks anyway. What's causing you to go home? I'm getting a little worried." My heart sank, man. I hadn't seen my parents in a while, and they were visiting in town. That's why I was going home. So that day, my university best friend, Alex, called me, and he said, "Hey, I want to start this company, and would you co-found it with me?" And I said, "Dude, as long as I can build a company that I want to work for, I'm in." Like, I was just mentally out here, right? And he had a unique background. After engineering, he got into Johnson & Johnson's engineering leadership program, built software there. Then he did a startup that failed and felt he needed to study accounting and finance. And that unique combo of engineering and accounting finance took him into the world of R&D credits, R&D tax credits. So globally, hundreds of billions of dollars are given in government funding and R&D tax credits to support businesses who invest in innovation and product development. The unfortunate thing is it's a cumbersome application process like anything government. It's prone to frustrating audits, and receiving the money takes a long time. Anything well-intentioned, if marred in red tape, you know, the intention is lost, right? So he said, "I've been doing this for a big four accounting firm, and I want to go out on my own and do this." And I'm like, "Let's do it, man." And he was in Calgary at the time, and we were moving to San Francisco because my wife had got a job at Stanford. So that was the journey. That's how we started the company. And I moved to Calgary, where he was there. And I spent a good year there, shuttling back and forth between San Francisco and Calgary. But fast forward today, now we're in San Francisco, we're in Texas, we're in Calgary, Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, and expanding to Europe hopefully soon. But that was how I went. But like that experience of communication, creation, and consistency is critical for being an entrepreneur, right?
Well, and your co-founder, Alex, he has another hack that I tell people about, where, you know, sales, like we were talking about, is an unbelievable hack for life. The next one is understanding accounting and finance. If you understand accounting and finance, it is, personally, how do you manage your own money? Like, a lot of people don't understand that and get themselves into trouble. If you really want to understand how a business works, if you understand how the money flows through a business, like, it's everything. Like, I recently hired a president to run my software consulting firm, Blueprint. And, you know, he's like a pro at building teams to do all the professional services and all, like, he's just an animal with it. But he never really ran his own business. And we were going through a conversation about, you know, strategy and priorities and all of that. What should he be focused out of the gate? And he came back with this great list of like, here's all the things I should be focused on. Like, this is all brilliant. Like, you want to know what I think the number one thing you should be focused on? He's like, "Yeah, of course." I'm like, "Cash flow. Do you understand the cash flow of this business? Because it's going to impact every single one of these things you're wanting to do. And if you don't understand the cash flow, you're not going to make it work. So it's been a fun journey with him to see him go, wait a second, this is a different way to look at this. This is a different way to expand my mind and understand how to really build this business in a different way. So your co-founder, I think, was smart for figuring out accounting and finance.
You know, we had a great partnership all the way from college, right? I was the front facing. He built the project, even for our undergrad thesis, was collision avoidance on real time vehicles. And he coded it. I was the presenting factor. So we had a good dynamic there. I was the GTM front. He was everything accounting, finance, operations, and we worked really well. And that combination, you know, when you find a co-founder, you got to have two things. One is complementary skill sets, so you're not up in each other's grill. And the second is alignment. Great companies, great communities, great cultures are built on great alignment. If you don't have alignment going in, when you're starting out, you're surviving, right? You're poor, you have no money. Yeah. And so you'll say yes to a lot of things and you'll make do. But as soon as money comes, if there's no alignment, it'll start eroding. The culture will start eroding. People will see that misalignment because somebody will say north and you'll say south. So I think those two things are very important, is figuring out what your values are and aligning going in. I know it sounds cheesy, but trust me, you know, now writing the book and talking to hundreds of companies and thousands of leaders, great companies, great cultures that are everlasting are built on great alignment. It's very important to understand your purpose, your vision, your mission, and more importantly, your values, because your values tell you how you show up every waking hour. And if there's no alignment with your co-founder and there's no complementary skill set, it's going to only lead to friction, right? That's your first step in building a company. So that journey with us worked extremely, extremely well. And I can dive into, you know, getting the first customers and building the company in phases, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, so like the two areas I want to really get into with some of the challenges you faced, your physical and mental health, the personal journey, because I think there's what you've done in that whole space is inspiring for people to understand, like your motivation and what drove you. And then also I love talking with you about building startups in phases. So wherever you want to go.
Definitely. Let's start with building startups in phases, because I think that is key, because the mental health issues came after. And I'll tell you, the mental health issues actually came after I exited the company. And that is one thing that is important to keep in mind, is all our life we chase success looking for happiness. Somebody else's definition of success, right? What your mom tells you, what society tells you, what your VCs tell you, triple, triple, double, double, or some obscene unicorn porn valuation, or somebody else's definition of success, which is driven by society. If you don't draw joy from that chase at the end, you'll feel lost and burn out, right? So I'll dive into that in a sec. But when we started Boast, the way we started the company was, again, going back to the ethos of communication and community. We started first cold calling, and we started reaching out to everyone. First client set being, let's reach out to manufacturing and construction and oil and gas since it's Calgary. What we found very difficult was people wouldn't take our calls really or take us seriously, right? You got two guys in an apartment who nobody has heard of saying, give me your data and I'll give you money from the government. It sounds scammy in many ways, right? Especially when the big four accounting firms are doing it. So then we started pounding the pavement and going to the events of manufacturing companies, oil and gas events, construction events. And we couldn't fit in with that tribe. We just couldn't find our way there. Then we started going to startup events. And that felt more like our tribe, our people. We could have conversations. We could communicate. We participated in a number of hackathons. And we really got to understand that, hey, this is our tribe because we're founders as well. And what we found is inadvertently a few things. We got to understand the customer better and their pains and also their aspirations. Of course, we didn't think of frameworks back then. We didn't build it. We chanced into these things. So we got to understand the customer real well. And two things came out from that customer development exercise is, one, at the time, all the events that were happening in that region were all high-level CEO platitudes. Some 10, 15, $50 billion CEO, $50 million CEO, $100 million CEO would come and talk about how they build the company aspirational, not tactical. Now, that wasn't helpful for us, and it's not helpful for any other founder, right? It's all platitudes. It helps. But as a founder that's 0 to 1 or 1 to 5, what do I want to know? How do I get my first customers? How do I figure out a channel? How do I build the right product? How do I hire and convince a developer? How do I raise my first money? How do I negotiate a big enterprise deal? So that wasn't happening. Now, as a function of us being in and around startups before, we're like, hey, why don't we host our own meetups, right? And so we started hosting our own events, and our emails went from being buy my stuff to, hey, Brandon, we're inviting speaker X to speak about like how to negotiate your first term sheet or how to negotiate your first enterprise deal or whatever, very tactical. And we got 10 spots and some pizza at the co-working space. All 10 showed up because it was an influencer for that ICP, for that ideal customer profile, talking about a topic they cared about. The next time we did the event, more people showed up, more people showed up, more people showed up. One day we hosted an event and 200 people showed up at the co-working space, man. And the co-working space is like, guys, this is not a meetup anymore. We had like, this is not a pizza night. We hijacked all, you know, the desks in the rows of the co-working space. We had Saeed Amidi, who is a founder of Plug and Play in Silicon Valley, and some VCs. It was big. And that evolved eventually into what the Traction community is today, about 120,000 subscribers. We host big events with like CEOs of Atlassian and Uber have been to our events. CEO of Twilio has been to our events, et cetera. But that was the stage for it. And the reason why we did that was we're like, the only way to build social proof is through community. If we keep cold calling people and nobody knows you, how are you going to build social proof? So now what happened was we'd invite these influencers to speak. We got the brand rub of the influencer. And now people would be more likely to have a conversation with us. Plus, we our messaging and our vibe was resonating with our ideal customer. So that became our first audience. In parallel, what we did was we also saw that that was a time where nobody was supporting startups. This was 2012, right? So all our competitors are like, ha, you guys are going to go bankrupt servicing the startup market. Like, you know, they never pay on time, all of this stuff. And the media wouldn't cover startups. And we're like, man, we're the same startup founders. If the customers you serve won't talk to us and you won't serve people like us, then only we can serve ourselves, right? Basically, we can only serve our audience. Now, fast forward today, that bet played out in a big way because we said, we're going to service the startup market. Me being in Silicon Valley was beneficial because I was seeing firsthand how funding was going into startups. And the bet was startups are going to be the fastest growing market. Now, fast forward today, all these accountants, bankers, lawyers, they all have startup programs who were initially telling us, hey, you, these guys are not going to pay you. But building it for us helped us build a tribe because there were a lot more startup founders with us, like us, who weren't getting help. Now, in parallel, what I did was I said, okay, now I can also start writing content about startup advice, but I'm like, the SEO juice is going to take years to take impact, maybe 2 years. It won't drive us anything. So I said, what is the most social proof here? We got the social proof of the speakers and their influence. So we're building that personal brand in person, but how do we take this online and get some SEO? So I saw none of the media, like the local newspaper, wasn't covering startups. So I reached out to them and said, hey, can you give me a column and I'll cover startups? And they're like, go away. Like, we don't care about this and all this stuff, right? They would say. And then what I did was I guest blog in a couple of other media sites and I shared it with them. And I'm like, okay, give me an online column at least. And it was a Post Media, the local Calgary Herald newspaper. So they gave me an online column. They said, we'll test it out. I wrote a column, Startup of the Week. And obviously when a startup, that's, you know, the one thing startup founders and grassroots people have is a lot of love, right? When you cover them, they share it and it goes viral in many ways. So the first post I wrote, I shared with the founder, he shared with all his family, the network, the local community was like heralding me for bringing a voice to startups. And that post went viral. And then I get an email from Calgary Herald saying, hey, if you commit to writing it every week, we will run this in print. We will run this in print means now you are legitimized, right? Now the startup founders are waking up at 6 a.m. every Monday to collect the print copy of the Calgary Herald, take a photo and tweet it, post it on their LinkedIn, post it on their Facebook. So that social proof, what it gave me was at a time where SEO was a long game. The meetups gave us immediate social proof and access for conversations and build that network. And the guest blogging, which eventually turned into, which within a week turned into a print column, gave us the social proof from a large national newspaper. And I consistently wrote that guest. And how much I hate writing. My mom knows and my wife knows. I would procrastinate an hour before submission. I do the interviews that are recorded and then an hour before submit it. But nonetheless, for 2.5 years, from 2012 to about 2014, I wrote that column, rain or shine, every week, and it went in print. And I think that social proof drove our brand, and it helped us become visible, then credible, and then profitable. And that is the journey. A lot of people ask me, how do I build community? When can I monetize? If you want to monetize immediately, do direct response stuff. Maybe do trade shows, invest in ads, cold call. If you want to build a community, you got to have the ethos of giving and understand that it's a labor of love. It's a marathon of the heart and mind. It takes a while. Do that in parallel and give, give, give. It's truly, you got to be visible, then you'll become credible, then eventually you will become profitable.
So smart, especially in even today's market and the challenges that everyone's having with building pipeline and sales in general, and how do you get awareness? And like, I was reading an article earlier this morning about the old school BDR approach is dead. Content is king. And that's kind of a theme that's been happening for a while. So content, content, content. But it has to be good content. It has to be relevant content. And it has to be smart content. What you were saying about this article or this column is really smart, because you picked up on a key thing. Like, all of these founders want brand recognition. They want attention. They want awareness. And by you doing that, of course they're going to evangelize it. And shout it from the rooftop. So really, really smart.
So I want to distill this down into a few frameworks for entrepreneurs, right? Because I shared it in terms of my story. Now let's take it like maybe 10,000 foot up into frameworks. So startups are built in phases. Phase one is validation. What is validation? You have an idea. You need to make sure that that idea resonates. You talk to 100, 200 people. That's the leading indicator, is conversations. And if you're in B2B SaaS, can you get 10 people that are not your mother, brother, sister, your family members to pay you to try it out? You have message market fit. You have, customer has a problem. Your idea resonates. They'll pay you to try it out, pilot it. They're making some investment. The next phase is product market fit, right? Now, so at validation, it's all founder led. You're pounding the pavement. You're making the calls. You're not hiring people. You're doing it. And this was our journey, right? Us, me and Alex, pounding the pavement doing this. The next phase is product market fit. Product market fit, again, you're not investing in marketing and sales and a ton of other things. It's still founder-led. It's still elbows out, like you're operating like a pirate. The leading indicator of product market fit is the people who paid you to try it out are engaged in the product. They're using it. And the lagging indicator is they don't leave. Meaning every time I have the problem, I came to you to use it for the solution. Validation is, I have a problem, your message resonates, I'll try it. Product market fit is, every time now I have the problem, I'm going to keep coming back to you. So retention is the leading indicator of product market fit, and engagement is the leading indicator of retention. And there, maybe at that point, you hire, you know, your customer base maybe grows from that 10 to 40, 50, and maybe you hire two sales reps. You're not, you know, at validation, you're an individual contributor. At product market fit, as a founder, you may have a fancy title. My title was president, Alex was CEO. At product market fit, when you hire two people, you become a manager. You don't become an executive. Then you get to product channel fit, where you figure out one repeatable, scalable channel to acquire customers. Now, you could short circuit some of it so it happens in parallel, like it did for us. When you're at product channel fit, you figure out that one repeatable, scalable channel, then you're at a point also that you've hired a manager to manage ICs and you become a VP. And I say stretch being that VP for the longest time as a founder. Don't abstract to being a C-suite, because until you hit scale, it's all about one kind of customer coming to one kind of channel, getting one kind of value, and it's all about execution and urgency and speed of execution. Now, when you're at scale and say you're north of 5 million in revenue, 4 or 5 million in revenue, you have a repeatable, scalable channel to get customers, you have high retention, you've nailed down an ICP, then you're taking 75% and putting fuel on the fire. More, whatever works. Say you had community, invest more in community. Invest more in doubling down on the same ICP. Make the product better. And 25% of the time, try new things, maybe new channels, new markets, new product ideas, your second act at scale. But again, that 25% of the time, you need to go back to the drawing board in those same phases. What I see a lot of founders do is they right away say, oh, you know what? We've raised some money. Now let's build a team in Europe and let's build a second product team. Well, you had no money. When you had no money, you got a customer for a problem. You validated it. You methodically took them to product market fit and then through product channel fit and then at scale. So you got to be very, very methodical. And a lot of times we are not permitted to be on that methodical journey when we raise money on misaligned expectations, right?
Yeah. Yeah. When you raise money just to raise money because you're told to, and now you got to go spend the money because you're told to spend it. Like, it's easy to spend money, but it's not as so easy to make that money make money. Well, we're running short on time, but there's a question that I always like to ask on the show. What do you think, like, in the world that we live in right now in 2023, what do you think founders and execs should be focused on?
I think definitely, because you asked me this question about mental health and I said I'll get into it later. It's a stressful time and I think mental health is really, really important, right? So, you know, fast forward, we built this community, both grew over the years, and, you know, our product as it went from validation to product market fit to scale was we delivered a service manually, then we used no code tools, we used Zapier and Zoho Creator to build the first version, and it was automating or digitizing a service, and then eventually we productized it from the ground up, right? And the company grew, and during the pandemic we ended up doing a deal with the growth equity firm, selling about 52 some odd percent, cashing out, and I transitioned out of the company. Now when I transitioned out of the company, I actually hit rock bottom, man. I felt like I lost my tribe. And if you look at my journey from summers in the slums to Gulf War to the HubSpot community to the Traction community, all my life I was part of a community. And when I left the day-to-day, I should have been excited. I came into money that I'd never seen before in my life. I could finally actually have fun. I hit my parents' definition of success. I hit my in-laws' definition of success. But I ended up depressed and I was going crazy. And what I realized is I ran so hard all these years putting work number one, and I never put anything else number one. I didn't prioritize my health. I didn't prioritize my family. And that's why I felt lost. And this is what we founders do a lot, right? There's 100 things you can do, right, in 2023. You can focus on cutting down where you take big risks. Take the biggest bets, not every bet. Focus is key, number one. You can focus on profitability. You can stop spending frivolously. All of that stuff you can do. There are good business hygiene, right? Ultimately, what is a successful business? Customers are happy, or rather, first, employees are happy. If employees are happy, customers will be happy, and cash is in the bank. If employees are happy, you have customers who are happy, and you have money in the bank, your business is great. A job of a leader is to build, inspire, and motivate a team to deliver. Deliver is a lagging indicator. And so if you treat people with love and help them grow, they'll treat your business with love and your business will grow and explode. But for you to be able to do that, you should be able to take care of yourself first. If you don't take care of yourself, put your oxygen mask first, you'll burn out, you'll stress out, right? And so I found myself running all the time. And when the time came that I wasn't in the day-to-day of the company, I felt lost, I hit rock bottom. And I didn't know what to do with the money. So I started spending frivolously. I invested in a lot of startups that all mostly tanked. I was traveling from place to place, calling friends and saying, hey, you know what? Come to Dominican or come here, come there. I'll pay for the flight. And I think things came to a head when I was in Romania. I was at a conference speaking and there was a speaker retreat after. And now we're at 2 a.m. at a pool 3 hours from Bucharest. And I'm frantically calling an Uber. I keep calling the Uber and they're like, no Uber is going to come here at this hour. Finally, 30, 40 minutes later, an Uber comes. I'm like, guys, hold up a second. I pop up my laptop. I book a flight to Costa Rica. because I had friends who called me 2 hours ago. They said, we're in Costa Rica. I pack my bags and we head to the airport and I just make the 7:30 flight or 7 a.m. flight. That's how crazy I got. And my wife looks at me one day, she let me grieve given she's a physician. And she's like, man, if something happens to you, we're going to be left holding the bag. You need to get a grip on yourself. And that day I found my Peloton bike, which was full of clothes and turned into a clothing rack. I shoved it aside, hopped on the bike. And the instructor that came on actually was bringing her vulnerable self. She said, I'm coming back from maternity leave. I don't feel so strong. I feel weak. I can't ride. And then she yells out, self-pity is toxic. One crank, one shift, one ride around the block. I am, I can. And I felt so connected to her and the riders on Peloton that my journey with community again started, made friends who were into fitness and health, and I transformed. And that was also the reason why I wrote the book is, you know, around the same time I had a chat with Atlassian's president Anu, and she told me self-care is never selfish. It's good stewardship towards the only way you can create value in the world. And she said 15 years working in tech, she felt burnt out and she went to quit. And Atlassian CEO said, don't take a break. So she took a sabbatical, traveled, went to Antarctica, spent time in Tacoma Desert, rehabilitated animals, and came back to become the president of this $40 billion company. And so those two things and the help and support of the community is what brought me back to good health and mental peace. And as I reflected, I said, you know what? I've had a great journey. Everything I am, including the business, including the investors finding us, our growth equity firm that ended up acquiring majority of the company, they came to a traction event and found us. Literally, and the deal happened within a month. So I had a lot for the community to thank. And the only time I felt depressed was when I lost the community. So I started reading all the content around the past traction events. We had like 300-400 videos. I started rewatching. I started talking to other community leaders. I started looking into all the iconic brands out there that started from obscure ideas and actually found some common themes. One, every obscure idea that became a global phenomena has a very common path, four-step path, from Christ and Christianity to CrossFit. Common path of every obscure idea from Christ to CrossFit that became a global phenomena. People listen to you, you have an audience, you bring that audience together, it becomes a community when they connect with one another. When the community comes together to create impact that transcends your product or your profit, create an impact that's towards a greater purpose, it becomes a movement. And when the movement has undying faith in its purpose through rituals, it becomes a cult or a religion. That was the common path I found. And so I distilled all those learnings from those conversations into 13 common rules to build iconic brands with community-led growth. I didn't write this book to make money, or I didn't write this book because, you know, I did a company, now I want to write a book. I did this book because of my love for community and, you know, the only time in my life that I was depressed and hit rock bottom was when I felt I was losing the community. And so when I was back in good health and I had all the free time in the world, I said, I want to give a gift to the community and pay homage to the community. And that's why not only my story is probably very little in that book throughout the chapters, but it's covering every obscure idea from B2C and B2B that eventually became a global phenomena, and what were the commonalities from exponential companies that grew to 10x to iconic brands and cult-like movements. I cover that journey so people can take inspiration, because think about what's happening in 2023 here, right? What has generative AI done?
Yeah.
The world is swimming in a sea of sameness. In fact, you know, once the novelty ends, everything eventually gears towards becoming a commodity, right? In a world that's increasingly influenced by generative AI, the book is meant to reignite the conversation around the unique power of authentic human connections in building enduring brands. Because if you think about it, yesterday's innovation is always tomorrow's commodity, right? It was first the internet, then came the cloud, then came mobile, then came social. Remember, we used to say internet company, then we used to say cloud company, then we used to say mobile company, then we used to say social company. Now we're saying AI companies. We don't say mobile, web, cloud, internet company anymore, right? We're not going to say AI company either. But what is consistent is the power of people. And one example to close this out, in the 80s, Harley Davidson almost went bankrupt when the Japanese manufacturers came in and were building bikes. The leadership of Harley stood up and said, community is going to be a company strategy, not a marketing strategy. A lot of people, they want to hire a marketing manager and shove community in the marketing department. They made community a company strategy. Leadership went out and started biker clubs, rider clubs around the camaraderie of bikers and shared brotherhood of riding. Riders became employees. Employees became riders, started a movement to save Harley, but started several movements to save people from breast cancer and autism. And today you can recognize a Harley fan just by what they're wearing.
Totally.
And so yesterday's innovation always becomes tomorrow's commodity. Ultimately, don't get caught up in the AI hype. Ultimately, people do business with people. Despite all the AI that's happening in the world, when you follow somebody on Instagram or TikTok, you're scrolling content from people, not from brands, right? And so brands of yesterday were built on what they told the world about themselves, and brands of the future will be built on what the community says about them. If you build a community, you will not become a commodity.
Wow, sage advice there. So I'm excited to get my hands on your book, Grassroots to Greatness, here in the next few weeks. Thanks for coming on and sharing your story and sharing some wisdom. I can't wait to chat more.
Definitely. Thanks so much.
All right, Lloyd. Everyone else, Cash and Burn comes out every Tuesday. Thanks for tuning in.